Carver, and my name is Natalie Peters. I'm here with Mrs. Carver. If you'll give your full name?
Margaret Murray Carver.
And it's not, there's nothing formal. Start anywhere you'd like.
Yes.
What brought your family to Harford County?
Well, I think the potato famine brought my father's people to Haverty Grace. They immigrated from Ireland, and then he was born after they'd been in Haverty Grace a couple of years. They were fishermen, I think, probably in Ireland. And then they came here to the fishing village, the Irish fishing village, which is what Haverty Grace was.
And what year was that about?
I have to think now. I honestly don't know. I could find it, though.
Was it before World War II?
This was before the turn of the century.
I see. Okay.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And your family came here, so you were born in Haverty Grace?
Yes, mm-hmm. At home, in a 3-day blizzard.
Tell me that story.
And Dr. Smith attended us. My mother had 11 children, 2 years apart, except for one break where there were 3 years. And they raised 10 of them. One died of pneumonia at the age of 10. And it was very hard because we didn't have a big house. And times were hard back then. But life was very stable. You didn't expect anything to change because nothing did. Everybody lived in the same place. And we had a garden and chickens, most people did. And no one left town. And at that point, not many people came to town. Everybody knew everybody in our end of town, but there was the other half of town, which was Italian, and it was like another town, and the children met at school. When we got to school, we knew the children, but it was all two separate towns, really, for all my years there. I left Haverty Grace at the age, well, gradually left Haverty Grace and went to stay on the farm of close friends. And when I was approaching the senior year in high school, my family moved to Washington. They had been going gradually, the older children finding employment there. And then it became sensible for my parents to follow and take the younger boy, but I had to stay one more year in Haverty Grace because it would be silly to uproot me. So I stayed there on the farm, and that was, I visited, but I really had two homes, one in Washington and one in Haverty Grace. In those times, Haverty Grace was far less outward looking than it is now. People didn't expect to go away to school or to, you know, a lot, most people didn't, and didn't expect to do anything but get out of high school, either go to business school or go to work. And then if you went to business school, it was a short course of 3 or 6 months, and then you worked. And whatever employment there was what you took.
Can you describe Haverty Grace for me? What are the visual recollections that you have?
Well, we lived on Revolution Street, and across the road was a swamp with cattails in it. We never went in that swamp, of course. We would have been terrified to do that. That's where the Citizens Nursing Home stands now. It's the back of that. And when I saw them digging it up, I could hardly believe that they were going to put something on that. And they did, of course, with the condominiums. But that earth was so black and wet. I didn't see how anything could be made to stay there. We lived on the other side of Revolution Street, and we walked to school, the Haverty Grace Elementary School. And everybody had grape arbors and gardens and rose bushes, and It was just so pleasant. It was such a pleasant little town for a child. Nobody really made a big fuss over your comings and goings. You didn't have anything to go to. You just had your time was your own as a child, most of all of us. And it was very unrestricted because what's going to go wrong? Nothing's going to happen to you. So it was a very pleasant thing from that point of view. It was also very cold in the winters. I stood at the shore and watched older children out on the ice skating, and adults too. I think it was around that time that they put that railroad, that road across the river, Corduroy Road, I believe, and took things across the river that way. Don't think it's frozen like that for many years now.
You mean they took it across the ice? They took things across the ice?
Yes, there's a steel grating of that in the that road in the in our local historical society. They have it, or they did have it down at the Hayes House, so you can see that.
Can you remember that?
No, I don't think it may have been in my time, but I don't remember it. It may have been considerably earlier than when I was born. I was born in 1916.
What other recollections do you have of that early time in Happy Place? Do you remember?
I remember the White Chapel, and that was an interesting place. And it was really a very beautiful little building, looking back. And the railroad went past it, the railroad that would through what they called the cut, and it went down to the river. And the canning house was there, and they would load the trains. And,
was this the Ma and Pa Railroad?
Oh, no. That's no, it was, I guess it was a spur of the Pennsylvania, I don't know. But anyway, it must have been. Mm-hmm. And because the Pennsylvania Station was not far up there. And they carried the goods from the canning house and shipped it.
Do you remember the canning house?
Yes, I do. It was when I was little. Mm-hmm. I never actually went in the canning house, but the building remains there to this
what
day.
What do you remember about it? What was your impression of it?
I didn't really have an impression at all. Mm-hmm. I know that a lot of people came to work there, but I never saw them. I do remember when the Conowingo Dam was built. My sister was about 16 and far too young to even think of marriage, but you know what? She married one of those young men. He was from the South and a very nice young person, and she married him and moved to Washington. And that was the first move of many among the older children. Each one went because the other two were there and found employment and better jobs than they could dream of getting in Haverty Grace. And my brother was, what was it they called, rationing feed bags in Murray Lauder's store. That was his work. And he went to Washington with the idea of doing something more useful, more productive. And he went to take the fireman's exam. They thought that would be a good field, and he could do that. He had experience as a volunteer fireman. But it didn't work out. They didn't have that exam that day, but they had the police exam. And Robert became chief of Metropolitan Police in time. So that was a very nice career for him. It worked out beautifully. And when my father and mother went, which was in, I guess, 1931, he had never lived anywhere but Haverty Grace. Well, she had lived in, she came from Delaware, and he had only lived in Haverty Grace. And he took a compass with him when he walked in Washington to make sure it didn't get lost.
Which makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember the lighthouse in Haverty Grace?
Oh yes, I learned to swim at the base of the lighthouse. It was very rocky, and first I learned the dead man's float. What happened was, we would wake in the morning and get up and get ourselves in our bathing suits, go out to the garden and get a nice warm tomato, take salt with us, and eat the tomato, and that was breakfast. My mother had so many children that if she knew if we were hungry, we would tell her, and she didn't have to have a big crowd all the same time to breakfast. She just let us do as we liked, and the food was around. We had a tomato and went down and swam, and the older ones took care of the younger ones, and I learned the dead man's float and ran into the rocks and cut my lip, but at least I found out that I could stay afloat. And then my older sisters taught me to swim. And it was really very, very nice. We went in a crowd and we swam till we were exhausted or just swam out and hungry. And we go home. And we lived a block from it, just about a block. So it was very pleasant. And you never were lonely. Always plenty of company, just in our house even, just enough. There was so much company in the house that you didn't need to really go outside for dinner. But everybody seemed to be at ease with the surroundings. One time, my most adventurous older sister and I decided that the weather was so warm in April that we would go swimming. And everybody else was off doing things. And we went down and got in that ice-cold water and swam. Or tried to, but we came out looking like we were bleeding. We were red. Yeah. It was very nice. We went across the river to Owens's Wharf. Do you know where that is? It's no longer Owens's Wharf. They sold it a couple of years ago, but through all my life it's been there. A great place to go get fish. But we went over there and swam. And there was the island in between Harry Grace and Perryville. And we started out to swim over to that, but then we understood. People were saying and told us as we struck out that when you got there, you couldn't find any footing and it was swimming, you know. So we finally turned back, didn't have the courage to do it, but it was an easy swim. It would have been an easy swim if you knew what you couldn't find when you got there.
Do you remember any other things that you all used to do together, your brothers and sisters? Did you never went ice skating?
No. I tried once or twice with somebody else's skates, but I didn't learn to skate on ice. We did a lot of roller skating down around the Bayou Hotel in that area. The sidewalk was smooth there, and we just skated all the time down there, and no problem with that. But when the races came, that was very exciting to the kids. And then sometimes I remember, as a young girl, too young to be part of the crowd, but interested, we, all of us little kids, would go out to the back of the hotel, Bayou, and between there and the water, and watch the dancers. And it was, really an exciting event to be out there watching the dancers.
Were they rehearsing?
No, they were older people. They were the young people who were old enough to go to a dance. And we could watch with envy. But then some people went, again, the ones who were older than I was, got to go on the Emma Giles. That was a boat that took them down to into the bay away. Tolchester is where they went. And then they'd come back, and there was a moonlight. It was called a moonlight, and couples would go, and they just had a wonderful time, I think, on those things. But that was gone by the time I got big enough to do it.
Tell me about the races.
Oh, well, that was very exciting. When I was 10, well, on the farm, I speak of the farm, that's the Tubbs farm, Dr. Tubbs and his family. His daughter, they had only one child. She was about 10 years older than I was. And she had been engaged to my older brother, and that's how I got to know her. And she invited me. She said, come out and visit us. you know, very politely and pleasantly. And I took that literally, and I put on my skates and went out and visited them. It was out toward Aberdeen a little way. I just went out by myself, didn't feel obligated to tell a soul where I was going. And, well, I started visiting there, and the time came when I was asked to spend the night. I could spend the night if I wanted to, but I had to call home. Well, I felt really bashful about that because I, you know, felt like I was trying to make myself important, but I didn't realize my mother wouldn't know where I was. Or I said, she knows where I am. I thought she knows where I went. Well, no, I wasn't allowed to stay unless I called home, so I did. But they had the buggy that took the judges around, and they would take the buggy over to the racetrack by the back part and across the railroad track and into the racetrack and pick up the toll judges and take them around and station them at various points where they could watch the race, making sure there was no foul play. And anyone, she could bring a buggy of friends. She could bring the extra seats they could fill, and I got to go that way. And I learned to handicap about the age of 10 or 11 and to read the racing form and figure out, you know, the favorites and all that. It was fun. And I was cured of gambling forever because the first $10 I earned, I blew on horses. Best thing that ever happened to me. But all the young fellows who were at an age to drive took whatever four wheels they could find and did what they call hacking. They hacked, which was serve as a taxi. And the traffic was so dense that if we tried to get out of the lane, this was a little later when I was 16, I was driving, and to try to come out of that lane, well, nothing for it. You had to wait till all the racetrack traffic was gone. It was, and also there were trains. The traffic was like that, and about like driving in Bel Air today, and down Route 1 right now. I was there about an hour ago, and it was terrible. And they had trains coming in, and all kinds of vehicles, buses, and it was a very exciting time for everybody. My sister told me that there were two business sections in town, Main Street, and then up in the other section, they each had its own bakery and its own little notion store and all that, all kinds of stores. And she said that those people, all of them, prospered and were able to leave something to their children. And the way they did it was this racetrack business brought a lot of business, a lot of people to town. And they didn't have to earn all year round any great amount, just if they did well during that period and got their fair share of business, then they could prosper. It's really great how it worked. And everybody seemed to catch the fever. It was like a fever. And at the races themselves, you would be sitting in the stand and looking down at this dense crowd over at the railing trying to see the actual finish usually. And you could pick out the movie stars because they were dressed in a way that people didn't dress. They were very much together, and their clothes stood out. They stood out. This is their whole purpose in life, to look right, and they had it down to a T. So you'd see a bluebird, perhaps, a woman in a bright blue outfit with the hat and everything blue, and they were a happy-go-lucky lot, having fun. It was so exciting, and people rented rooms. Those who had rooms would rent them to racetrack people, people who came just for that. And then the hotel was very good, and the restaurants all prospered. Expect the bars did too.
So it was a good thing for you.
Oh, it was. It was. It made the town far more sophisticated too than other small towns than it would have been otherwise. I think that's a good thing. people learned a lot about the outside world. From mind you, the people who came with the races were as varied as any gathering you could find. There were many, many people who loved the sport and came not as desperate gamblers, but people looking for some fun. And they were knowledgeable, able people who spent maybe 50 weeks a year in very responsible jobs, and then had this as their recreation. We had the races spring and fall. They made a circuit through Maryland. Laurel and Pimlico and Bowie was the last place they went to at the end. And wherever you went, when we went to Canada, the guards said, "Oh, Haverty Grace, oh yes, the racetrack town." Everybody knew it. It was the only mile and a quarter, one of the few mile and a quarter tracks in its time, at that time. And then as other states nearby got better tracks, then Haverty Grace went down, of course. But you could be in the grandstand is where most people, the big crowds went, and then of course they had the clubhouse, and that was more luxuriant. Wasn't a bit like going. I went to the races in Pimlico a couple of years ago for the first time all my life since I was a girl in Haverty Grace, and I couldn't believe it. You sat at a table and looked at your television, and then if you looked out there, you could see in the distance the races. None of the color, excitement, or contact with others, nothing. Nothing except just gambling. And it didn't seem to have any of the glamour and the excitement that we had then. And, you know, we had canning the businesses here in the county, and that added to the prosperity. That wasn't right in Haverty Grace, of course, but except we did have that one cannery that bought vegetables from the community, the surrounding land. And there weren't too many ways to earn a living in these small towns then. You could be, my father was a carpenter. And unless you were educated in a special field, it was hard to earn much of a living.
And especially so during the Depression, I
know. Oh, the Depression was a terrible time.
Tell me about it.
Just a terrible time. Well, you know, I came out of high school. I was bare 16. I had gone to school early because I was tall. And I was 16 in February and graduated in June. And so ignorant of the world, so absolutely sheltered, you might say, even in spite of having lived in a town that was a little bit more sophisticated than some, still, you know, we thought that that was the way it was. It would always be just that way. But it didn't dawn on us that life was change. Never found that out till some time later when things did change a great deal. I guess World War II maybe is where I learned that there it was ever changing. And I moved to Bel Air in 37 and married in 39. But they're really, these towns hadn't changed a whole lot then. This, of course, was a very different kind of town, being the county seat and having a lot of government business here. But as to any really big change, when I came to town, I was the new girl. There weren't that many new girls or anybody coming in to live here at that time. But you did, you moved because you had to for your job or something, but most people didn't just hunt for opportunities to move around or make a change. The change was thrust upon you then. But in the Depression, I never, of course you had a garden, but you didn't, and you didn't have to go without food, but things like coffee you had to go without. You couldn't have those things very much. And
clothing was hand-me-downs. That's what, you didn't have any money, was the thing. And if you weren't very secure, you would lose your home. A lot of people did that. And we were among them.
You lost your home during that time?
But,
how did that happen?
Just didn't have the money to keep up the mortgage. But we never were in the state of pain that a lot of people were. A lot of people really went hungry and, you know, went without the necessary medical care, things like that. And back then, everybody did their own housework and never would have dreamed. Most people didn't dream of having assistance in something that was their job. And the housewives would air their bedding first thing, and they'd have their washing done. Lots of them, you know, not every house had a washing machine, but every house did, the washing was done, and they did it from tubs. I've done washing in tubs on the farm. And the trick was to get it out early, get it on the line, dry it, bring it in, iron it, and put it back where it belonged that day. No fooling around. Just that's how housewives looked at things, and they had to do it themselves, and they expected to, and were very efficient about it. They didn't have big houses, but there were houses that were hard to keep clean because you had stoves. The first person I saw who died, one of the few people I've seen who died in the house, was sitting in an old lady sitting in a rocking chair beside a lovely little stove that burned coal. And she died of carbon monoxide poisoning. That's what they said.
Who was she?
I don't know who she was. She was in the house. She was staying in the house of some distant relatives of ours. And I happened to be there come there to the house before, you know, when it had just happened. And I really don't know her name. Her first name I knew, but I didn't know her other name at all. She was staying with them for a few days, maybe as a nurse, or I don't know just what. I don't think she was related. But that was not uncommon. And of course, things like typhoid fever were very prevalent then. And diphtheria, there was a lot of that. And the general practitioner took care of everything. He just did everything. And well, we all had the flu in the flu epidemic. Everybody in the house, I think, got the flu. And there were a lot of us in the house. And my mother and father had to stay on their feet, no matter how sick they were, to take care of the younger children and everybody. And my father went around with goose grease and rubbed our chests to keep the congestion down. I don't know how much good it did, but the attention helped. And I remember in our house we lost my sister's husband and her child, and my sister, the younger sister. They all died at the same time, and this was within a month during the flu epidemic. And I was just two when my sister's husband came home sick with the flu.
From World War One.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was only two, 1918. And he never recovered. The flu was a very hard thing then. I guess it was not having any medications to deal with it. But people then were so easy and carefree in many ways. They just took life as it came. And I think about Russell Baker's book, Growing Up. He told it better than anybody I've ever known, how it felt then. His family, he and his sister, had to be taken to a relative's house. Their mother took them and lived there with that relative. And they talk about how but simple little things amuse them, and how they sat and talked and had another cup of coffee and another piece of pie. They actually did do that, and they talked, and the neighbors would, they talked with the neighbors and with each other, and there was no end to the ordinary companionship of everyday living. And of course, there were a number of, in that case, that was an extended family situation, and that happened a lot. There were always other people in most houses, not in ours because there wasn't room. The older children were at home working to help, you know, with the family, and there was no reason. The boy below me. I had a boy below me.
So you're the 10th child.
Yes, and there's the last girl. And there's one sibling left. I have one brother who's living in Darlington. And the rest are gone. But I had 6 mothers and 4 fathers, you see. Did you?
Yes. Of course.
And nobody begrudged taking care of the little ones. Nobody thought they were being put upon, I don't think. It was just part of life. Is that the way it was with you? Nice.
Tell me about, now did you have nieces and nephews at this time? It's just.
Oh, I have a lot of them, yes. One came and lived with us from 9 to 19. And she, at 19, she had gone, well, she went to Merrill Institute, and when she was standing in the registration line, she met Mike Vandiver and married him. And he was the nephew of the Vandiver house, or the grandson. And those two live up in Freeland, and they're my main support because she's like more daughter than niece. And then she has 2 siblings who are very close to me. And then my brother's children, he had 6, and they're all just so good and kind to me. All have prospered well, and they take time to come and see me and take me out somewhere, take me to a little antique sale or some kind of event, you know, that I'll enjoy. And I go to see him on occasion. Not often, but I see him, of course, at family, little family affairs. When some of the children have a party, he and I are both there. And it's a great blessing to have that many around me. To have to go into a retirement home would be a nightmare for me. So I plan to see it through right here. I'm very lucky to have a place like this to live in. And I appreciate it. And we're living now in a time when you get so much wonderful help if you want to stay at home and not be in an institution. So I lucked out. I came into the right time.
Tell me about how Harford County has changed in your life.
Well, you know, I didn't know much of the county as a young girl. Just Haverty Grace. And by the way, in Haverty Grace, there was a butcher shop, and the sign of a butcher shop in those days was a hog's head. And when I was a little girl, about 4, I undertook to walk that long straight string that is Washington Street by myself without permission, without anybody's, without saying a word to anyone. And I walked all that long way, and suddenly I saw this horrible sight, and turned and walked back much faster. And when I got down to where we lived, close to the park, I told my mother about this horrible sight. And I gave up meat for 2 years. She told me where meat came from. And I gave it up for 2 years. I never found another kid that ever did that. Not one. But I was finally persuaded to eat certain meat about 2 years later. And I've never had to eat any of the things made from the hog's head, scrapper or anything like that. But in our house, you could do that, and nobody made any big thing of it. You were healthy, and that was what mattered. So nobody minded what that your particular choice. And as to Harford County, I came to Bel Air to the dentist at the age of about 14, and the old Richardson's drugstore was there. Our dentist was upstairs on Office Street, Dr. Steve Hopkins, a wonderful man, and a very good friend of my husband's. I didn't know that then, but it was like the pictures of old Bel Air. It was really a quiet town then, and you didn't see any traffic, and there were two drugstores, though. I think Boyd & Fulford's was there, and then on Office Street, the Getz drugstore was there. And when I first came here to live, I lived for a very short time up above the Five and Dime. I had a room there, and I couldn't stand that.
What didn't you like about it?
Seeing the partitions.
Rats, oh.
Well, there was a grocery store on that street, and, you know, they were business places, and I heard them, and I couldn't bear it. So I came out on Gordon Street to live. I found a room out there, and that was much, much more satisfactory.
Do you remember the name of the grocery store, or who ran it?
I seen Dave Preston was the manager of it, and Main Street Market, I think it was called. Mm-hmm. And there was the Vaughan Hotel right next door to it, I believe. It was, I think, in apartments at that time, but it had been the Vaughan Hotel. And Mr. Vaughan was around town then. Still, I knew him. And there was a movie down under. You know where you park now on this, between the bank, the commercial bank, and the Red Fox in there? Down under there, there was a bowling alley, and I went there once or twice, but I didn't really like to bowl, so I didn't go back there a whole lot. But then there was the corner restaurant, and it was upstairs, I believe. No, it was downstairs. I forget, there was something upstairs, a business, but I don't remember what it was. But we went there after dances, and
where did you go to a dance?
The Armory. The Armory was the big place to go to the dance, and their dances attracted people from all around, and my husband and I used to go to those dances. And there was a little post office. Let me think now. Where Lee Street is, very close to it, there was a little stone post office, I believe. And there was a church, a Methodist church, across the street, halfway up that block, somewhere above that Harrison's paint store, or somewhere above there, halfway up that block. I don't know what's in there now. I've forgotten what that company's called. And, of course, the post office was always where it is. And on the other side of the street was Miss Joe's boarding house. And we took our meals there. It was right at the Flatiron. And next door to her was Hollingsworth's, and Mrs. Hollingsworth, and she had a room or two, a couple of roomers. But they had good food in Miss Joe's boarding house. And
was it like a restaurant? Did
yes.
You pay for
well,
your meals?
Yes, you pay for your meals. And they had a one or two people. Dr. Sappington was one of them, lived there. He had a stroke, I think, and they looked after him. But it was primarily just for people who came regularly every day and ate their dinner there. And they had hot rolls and all kinds of wonderful things. And they were nice women. They were just as nice to you as they could be. But as to the growth of the town, it all happened so suddenly. For a long time, things were not changing much, and all of a sudden it exploded. And from then on, our efforts by that time we lived in this neighborhood. We had this house, which is 38 years old now. And the trick was to try to cut back some of the traffic. This was the only way to the Harford Mall, or it was the main way. And the traffic was just fearful. And things were growing at such an awful rate that there was hardly any controlling it. So they wanted to put up a whole lot of houses over here, what is now Catherine Court. I think we were going to have 81 condominiums. So we fought it and won. Our civic association was formed about 1975, and the history that we're writing now is a long history of struggle, with a lot of wins. We've had good support from the town, and they've been more than willing to hear the cries of agony from the people who live in this neighborhood. Now, it's changing a little because the people in West Bel Air houses, a number of them are rentals, and that is not the same as owners. If you're a renter, you don't feel as threatened if your home is going to have any problems, because you can always rent something else. But we right now are having a big struggle with Route 22. We do not want Route 22 to go through, and we feel that our neighborhood is threatened by that. So I was looking over an old newsletter from 75, and in the first paragraph it mentioned the problem that one of our big problems was the danger that Route 22 would go through our neighborhood. So it's been a 20-year struggle, but that's not bad. 20 years we've been able to keep our neighborhood free of that and that extra traffic. And you see, it would for a while make a little solution, but it isn't going to solve anything for any length of time, because the traffic's too heavy to be relieved by that.
Have there been any good changes with all of this increase of population?
Well, we used to always go to Towson to shop and to downtown Baltimore, and you don't have to do that anymore. Of course, that's a small matter, because truthfully, somewhere in between is where it was nice. It was a little more interesting, a little more lively. There were some people coming in that were, it was good to see some new people and to see the town prospering and growing. But when it got out of hand, I don't see too much good now about the traffic and the density of our population. I think when it gets that dense, people become uptight and aren't very happy about things. And they become more interested in suing, that kind of thing. Don't you think that's happening?
What is your fondest memory of Harford County, or Havity Grace specifically?
Well, I guess the freedom. That's the great thing about Harford County. Everybody could have whatever religion they wanted. Nobody fought anybody or criticized anybody. You were free to be a Republican or a Democrat or a whatever you wished to be. And there was no, it was very cosmopolitan in that sense, that it was a case of live and let live on almost any subject. People expected you to behave yourself, and that was about the limit of your restrictions. And you didn't even have to worry too much about it. There was very little crime. Nothing, you went freely day and night, thought nothing about it. And it wasn't just the exuberance and trusting ways of youth, it was also that the times themselves are very different. And I lock my door now. I would never have dreamed of doing that earlier. And it was just so easy to be what you wanted to be within the restrictions of limited money.
When did that change?
1942, you started to get more money.
The war.
You started to get more money then. You're
pay was better. You could earn more. I started teaching at $79 a month take home. 84 actually, but 79 was take home. Felt rich because it was steady. And we could buy a cashmere sweater in Baltimore. Went shopping whenever we got a paycheck, of course. And at 19, 20, what else? And bought cashmere sweaters for $2 to go in there. We made spring suits. And had just so much fun doing that kind of stuff. You didn't expect a whole lot more. And indeed, you didn't need a whole lot more. You didn't. There were no, you didn't have to have health insurance. Nobody even seemed to think much about that kind of stuff. And, of course, at that age, we didn't have to think about the future. Our future was working and eventually retiring. But I think that free, happy, easy, not happy necessarily, but that free atmosphere of being able to be whatever it was you wanted to be without losing your friends and your respect, everybody allowed you to be. I've never had to live in a place where, for example, you had to be a certain religion. Never. That's very fortunate. Has that been the way with you? You've had that too. That freedom to be what you were. And
do you think that's changed in Harford County? Or don't you still see that now?
I don't believe it's changed, not near as much as it has most other places. I think we're still very lucky in that way. There's a certain level of enlightenment here that you don't find everywhere. But you don't have the personal freedom, the safety, I'll say, that you did then. And you don't have the freedom from, I don't quite know how to put this. Now, lots of people do have an agenda. But nobody had an agenda then. Nobody was, you understand.
So closing, let me just ask you, if there's one thing you've learned over your time here, what would that one overall thing be?
Over all my time in Harford County, or on this earth, the thing I have learned is change is eternal, and it's the only thing that is.
That's great. Thank you very much.
Yes, indeed. Delighted.